Hello and welcome to Parade of Dicks. I am your host, Lucy Buttons, here with my co-producer, John L.
Hello.
Hello. And we have a very special guest tonight.
Very special guest.
We have my friend here. She's an HIV advocate, a burlesque performer and producer, and she has been living with HIV herself since 2011. Katrina, say hello.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, thank you so much for being here remotely. And your burlesque persona is known as Immodesty Rose, just so everybody knows who we're talking to. So I was telling your story to Janelle when we were talking about doing this episode.
And fascinating.
Found it very fascinating, as did I.
Thank you.
And very eye-opening. So I love that you're an advocate. I love that you tell this story and are open with people and educating people. So tell everybody how this happened.
So I was living in Maryland at the time, and I had this really normal, boring, middle-class existence. Condo in the suburbs, someone I was dating. He had two kids from his first marriage. We had a boxer and a minivan. So it was kind of really like really boring middle America. And I always say the life I'm living now is much more real and more authentic than the life I was living then. I just didn't know that this life was going to find me.
I can't picture you driving a minivan, by the way.
I'm not sure it was a good look. You know, if you do this one more time, I'm stopping the car. yeah, I guess I would have totally, can you be a step MILF?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I was totally a step MILF.
Nice.
Okay.
So at the time, the guy that I was dating, he and I had decided to start our own family. So we
kind Oh, you talked about it.
We did. We had planned. So, you know, and we had kind of like, you know, we're not going to use condoms. We're not going to use birth control. We had talked before when we had started having sex, like, hey, have you been tested? Yes. Have I been tested? Yes. Okay. So I was under this assumption that we were both, you know, responsible adults. Mm-hmm. We were both working in the healthcare field. So I thought this was something that we would have both taken very seriously. And then, when I was pregnant, I got meningitis and I ended up in the hospital.
And so you got pregnant. Really, how long in between having that conversation, deciding until you got pregnant?
Very quickly. So I'm apparently very fertile. So.
And how long into the relationship were you together before you spoke of having this family of yours?
We had been together about a year. Like, it was just a very quick, very easy, very natural relationship. He was, you know, a very like caring, involved partner. You know, there were never any red flags. He was the kind of guy that if he had the evening off and I was working nights at the hospital near our home, like, he'd bring me dinner to work. Right.
So, okay.
So he was just kind of seemed like a very kind of caring, compassionate person. I got along with his family. He got along with mine. So it was just kind of a very easy interaction.
Okay.
And, you know, I was 31 and kind of like in that mindset of kind of, you know, this is what you do with your life in middle America, right? Like you
get married, you have a baby.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Bought a house, right? You bought a house?
I did, and I actually just sold that condo.
So congratulations.
Like my last trappings of my old life are now totally and completely gone.
Yay.
Yeah. Home ownership is really for the birds.
Okay, so you got pregnant, and then you got meningitis.
And the first thing I did actually was I broke out in this full body rash, like head to toe.
Like and itchy or bumps or describe it.
It wasn't itchy. It was just red and splotchy all over my body. And I went to like urgent care and they were like, oh, sometimes this can happen when you're pregnant. When you first get pregnant, sometimes your body can have this weird reaction. So I was like, all right, let's take a picture of this for posterity and kind of, you know, this will be, you know, funny on somebody's 16th birthday. And then I started having like really severe kind of like cold and flu symptoms and I was feeling really badly. And the guy I was seeing or the guy I was with like started becoming like very detached and like sleeping in the living room and uninvolved and just sort of very like unavailable. So I went and stayed with my mom and she had taken me to the emergency room. And the first time I went, they said, you know, this could be anything, go home. I went back a second time and they said, you know, your white blood cell count is low, but you're pregnant, which means your immune system is down. So we don't want to put you in the hospital because you could be more at risk of catching something in the hospital. So they sent you home.
Sure.
But I kept feeling worse. And I kept telling my mom that you need to take me back to the hospital. You need to take me back to the hospital. And she wouldn't.
And then, feeling worse, you mean weak or you mean
weak and dizzy and headachy and just hot and cold and hot and cold and just very disoriented. So, you know, my mother is one of these people. What will the neighbors think? So if you don't take me back to the emergency room, I'm calling 911 and you're going to have an ambulance in front of your house. Which that was just, you know, that was just, whoa, that would have been way too much.
Yes, that cannot happen. Okay.
No, we cannot embarrass anybody in front of the neighbors. So when I went back to the hospital, they admitted me into the kind of like maternal ICU ward because I was pregnant, and they put me in intensive care and they put me in isolation. So I was in this like huge room.
You
with
were
nobody
a bubble
else.
Woman.
Nice.
I was. And, you know, like doctors are coming in with like gowns and nurses are coming in with gowns and people are like trying to figure out what's going on. And then, you know, they took all this blood and they were running all these tests and, you know, they were actually doing like MRIs and x-rays, which they don't normally do when you're pregnant, but they were trying to figure out what was wrong. And it was like, I was at the point that I was so weak that like the orderly actually had to like lift me up. Wow. On the MRI table.
Okay.
And then eventually they diagnosed me with meningitis, which is an infection in your brain and spinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And then they released me from the hospital and I still didn't have my HIV diagnosis yet. But
I'm
I went
sorry, but to- what does one do for meningitis? Like, did they send you home with meds or what?
So it was viral. So there's not, it's called aseptic meningitis. So it's not a bacterial infection like the kind college kids get.
Sure.
So you can do, right. So you, and, but you're also pregnant, so you can't really take a lot. So it was really more treating the symptoms. So like treating my headache and treating nausea and treating dehydration. I actually got Reiki in the hospital, which was my first experience with that. And it was amazing.
And this was in your first trimester?
I was going to a cath.
I'm sorry. This was in your first trimester?
Right around, like, it was like around the, it was around the 4 month mark, I think.
Okay.
So beginning of my second trimester. And so they told me I could go home when I like stopped vomiting.
Okay.
So I was like holding food down in liquid. And then, so they decided to discharge me. And then when my mom was getting the car, I'm like, oh my God, I feel really nauseous. And she's like, you've been in here for a week. Cause I went into the hospital the day after Thanksgiving. She's like, just hide in the bathroom. I'm going to go get the car.
The neighbors might hear.
The neighbors might hear. Oh my God. And I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital, but it's just, it's a totally humbling experience and you don't sleep and the food is actually pretty terrible and people are interrupting you in the middle of the night. And, you know, you've got like these tubes coming out of your arms with IVs and, you know, I was kind of like, I guess some sort of like medical oddity. So people are just like coming to check me out and diagnose me.
So fascinating.
Like,
yeah.
It was. I mean, some of it like wasn't really classy. Like I needed a spinal tap done, which is where they take fluid out of your spine. And you know, like when you're in a hospital, you have that food tray that they serve your food on.
Yeah.
So that movable table. So they just put like a pillow on the table and like just had me lean over it and took this fluid out of my spine.
Jeez.
Yeah. It was kind of like, you know, the idea of like teenager safe sex is a pillow on the dashboard. Well, apparently like... Apparently, like, the anesthesiologist version is, like, a pillow over your dinner table. But when I got out, I went to see – my primary care doctor was someone I had worked with previously. And I had actually worked in a healthcare center that had a large HIV population. So I had been a case manager for 5 years for people living with HIV, and she had had a significant percentage of her primary care patients who had HIV. And she said that even though I hadn't been diagnosed with this in the hospital, that she wanted to run some tests and send me to see an infectious disease specialist at Johns Hopkins. And they ran the test. I went to see the doctor at Hopkins 2 days later, and he diagnosed me with HIV. So I always say the good thing is that I got a disease I know. The bad thing is I think I was so insulated from it, because from my doctor's opinion, I was 31, I was white, I was middle class. If you watch the video, I always stop and say, well, I guess I'm still white. And I had a decent income. I lived in the suburbs. I was well educated. I had my master's in social work. And I just didn't look like the profile of someone who is going to be diagnosed with HIV. So I wasn't tested for it, which right. is how I think, unfortunately, that I progressed to getting so sick. Because if somebody had kind of like stopped, like, oh, maybe we should check her for this, I probably wouldn't have gone down this course of action.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you told me when you told me this story was that it was also because you were in what was perceived as a straight monogamous relationship. So nobody asked any more questions than that. Is that right?
Correct. And I also worked in the field, so I knew the risk factors. But a heterosexual, middle-class, suburban relationship is, you know, not very exciting. Retrospectively, it was probably not very exciting being in it. I've gotten a lot more fun since then. But it just didn't, you know, rise to the level of anybody's attention, because so often, unfortunately, we still associate HIV with drug users, sex workers, and men who have sex with men. And so because I didn't fall into one of those categories, I wasn't tested. So I advocate to every woman, you know, no matter what kind of relationship you're in, you should still be getting tested annually for all STDs, just because no one can ever really be sure what one's partner is up to.
Sure.
If you know what I'm saying.
Unfortunately, I do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are some shady people out there.
I agree. There are.
I think we've all been cheated them, right? on. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why. That's what started this fucking thing. Yeah. So once you found out you had HIV, then what happened?
So
because you were really sick.
No fury, like a woman scorned.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You've been the recipient of that too, also, John L.
Of course, yes. I've been on both sides of the reciprocation point, like being angry and being beat up,
being cheated on,
yeah, and cheating. So I don't want to be the saint here, but you know, to walk us through the emotions of finding out something that you got this disease.
Well, I want to. I mean, what physically happened after that point? Because how do you treat it at that? You're like so sick. You're in your fourth month of pregnancy. Like, we want to know both. So tell us everything.
The two of those things are actually really related. So when I got the news, I knew I had not been with anybody else. Mm-hmm. So I figured he must have been with someone else. And, you know, I approached him and said, look, I have HIV, you have to get tested. And he said, oh, I had a needle stick years ago at the hospital. And in my head, I'm automatically calling bullshit because it's extremely hard to get HIV from a needle stick, because hospitals automatically treat you with PEP, which is called post-exposure prophylaxis, which is medicine that you can take immediately after an exposure to prevent you from getting HIV infection.
Right.
But it's also very hard because there's millions of needles out there, but not millions of needles with the HIV virus in them going around poking into people.
Right.
They just aren't flying around. So what I did was I figured I had helped him set up his online banking account, and I had the password for his online banking account. So I figured that was also the password to his email.
Okay.
So.
And it was.
So you went into his email.
Mm-hmm. So I went into his
email. Cracked that code.
I did.
By the way, and don't have the same password. Just for your own safety from my horrible dating experiences, keep the really important things with different passcodes than all of the other unimportant
things. Do not use password 123. pro tip.
Okay, but anyway, so you got in there.
Well, from his Gmail account, then I found a Yahoo account, which I didn't even know people were still using Yahoo. So sorry, Yahoo, but I was kind of on the outs. And that too had the same password.
Smart
and
guy.
And there I found his Manhunt account, which is similar to like Grindr, Adam for Adam, which is where men meet other men online for hookups and a lot of Craigslist encounters.
Okay.
So I knew now that he was having sex with men behind my back and sex with random men that he was meeting over the internet.
Sure.
So while this is going on, I was starting my HIV medication and going to see my primary care doctor, my infectious disease specialist, my HIV doctor, and my obstetrician.
And that's known as the cocktail?
I did start a cocktail. I did. So I started two medications. So HIV, the treatment of HIV has advanced. So they have four different classes of drugs. And in order to best treat it, they pick from three of those different classes. And sometimes that means you take two pills or three different pills. A lot of the pills, they now have one-a-day pills where they smush everything together into one pill.
Awesome.
Yay,
which
science.
Is... Yeah, right now I take one pill. Before, when I was pregnant, it was two pills. And then after I was pregnant and switched to just a regular regimen, it was three pills. But it was always all once a day. So it's not, you know, like the crazy, you know, battle days. I always say this is not your grandma's HIV.
Okay.
where people were taking like 14, 15, 16 pills throughout the day.
Yeah.
So I was going to all these appointments. I started taking my medicine. And so I was diagnosed on December 6th. I started medicine on December 7th. And then on December 19th, when I went for a sonogram, the baby no longer had a heartbeat. And I just looked at my mom and I was like, now I hate him.
Mm.
And, you know, up until then, I had kind of been okay with the process. And I thought, you know, that I don't know. It was kind of like this silver lining. And then all of a sudden that like silver lining kind of dropped out.
Yeah.
Although retrospectively, I don't want to say I'm glad, but in retrospectively, it was not the worst thing that happened because it allowed for a total complete separation
right.
between him and I that I wouldn't have been able to have if I had had a
True.
Child.
And obviously you were under other stress because of how you found out and all this happened. Were the doctors hopeful up until that point? Do you know the statistics on that? Because I certainly don't.
Lots of women with HIV get pregnant and have perfectly normal pregnancies and completely healthy babies that are HIV negative. 99% of the time, the baby will be HIV negative. In New York State, there were no babies born with HIV in 2012, 2013, 2014, or 2015.
Wow.
There was only one baby in the whole state born with HIV in 2016. And as far as I know, we haven't had any yet in 2017. So we're really good at preventing mother-to-child transmission.
Okay.
That's great.
But you were just too sick.
I was just too sick.
Okay.
Because I was diagnosed so late in the game, my body could probably only support one of us. And it, you know, your body's fight or flight response, it picked me.
Right. And also the stress of the situation you were in. I mean, that's huge with pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. And fevers are also really bad for pregnancy. And when you have meningitis, you have really high fevers. So it was just a lot of stress on both my body and, you know, the baby's body too.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I really tried to follow up with Matt to get HIV tested and he wouldn't do it. And I lied to him about not being pregnant anymore to try to force the issue. I also reached out to his ex-wife to tell her that she needed to get tested for HIV.
He was married before.
He was married
with the two kids.
With the two kids.
To a woman, yes, which is who he had the two kids with.
Okay.
And then she told me the reason they got divorced was because he had cheated on her with men. Okay. Which I don't know about you guys, but I felt like if I met my ex's new girlfriend, I'd be like, hey, did you know, like, there's this thing about him?
Yeah, I think that should be, it might be not as as pleasant as a conversation, but like either woman to woman or man to man, if your partner is developing a new partnership with the signs of possible problems in the future, a little heads up might be might be good.
Do you have you had a conversation with her since then about her status?
She was HIV negative, and
you told her you're positive.
I did tell her I was positive.
What did she say to that?
She was furious at him. She was very supportive and caring and accepting of me, and just really angry that that he had continued those behaviors and that he now had the HIV virus. And I think kind of, you know, she was really angry at the fact that, you know, he would take the kids every other weekend and that there was this kind of that, you know, I guess she didn't want to have to continue to be involved in his life either, because she considered him a pretty terrible person at that point.
Well, and I'm sure she was concerned about her children too, and their, you know, that's their dad.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But she didn't feel, she didn't apologize to you for not having not told you?
No, she just was like, oh, well, this, you know, I already knew that he was having sex with men. And I was like, you didn't think that. And she said, oh, he told me he told you and that you were okay with it.
And it's even more, this picture of this guy is so horrible in my brain right
now.
Yeah,
it's pretty bad.
And I know that there's, you know, over time I've come to understand there's internalized homophobia and internalized stigma and internalized shame. But at the time it was like, all right, buddy, if you were going to have sex with someone else, like, just do me a solid of putting on a condom.
Right.
Or making your partner use a condom. Because if he hadn't contracted HIV, I probably would never have known that he was sleeping with men, because he kept up this appearance of very, like, cisgendered male heteronormative lifestyle.
Right.
You were building a family, and you know, that that puts a veil on a lot of things that you kind of assume so many things once you start doing said activities, you know, going to gynecologists, you know, it's just, it's a shame that things that you need to be in the forefront are so buried deep in people's psyche that it affects so many people. And which leads me to my next question. I know I might be jumping the gun a little bit, but where's homeboy now?
What's gosh, I just found him on Instagram.
Oh.
Okay.
I have not friended him. So actually what happened is, not long after I lost the baby, he worked night shift and he fell asleep behind the wheel and totaled his car and walked away without a scratch.
So were you still together after you lost the baby? Because Janelle totally jumped the gun. Like, there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff. No, because like, I just assume that you bolt right after. But yeah, okay.
Living so I was staying at my mom's house, and my mother, bless her heart, I don't know what she did, but by the time, you know, I came home, he was gone, his clothes was gone, the dog was gone, the kids were gone, the kid stuff was gone, like not even a dog hair. Like, she must have put, you know, the fear of God in this man.
Yeah.
But I wanted him to know his status, because legally you can't press charges against someone unless they knowingly infected you in most states.
Right.
So I had no way to prove that he knew his HIV status. But what I wanted to make sure that I do is that if he passed on HIV to anybody else and they tried to press charges or seek some sort of, you know, support from anyone, that there's no way he could say he didn't know his status.
Right. And the thing is that you had those conversations with him too. Like the way you describe it, you know, you had the conversation about to stop using condoms. You had the conversation to have a kid. You obviously had relationship conversations. And so that's more than most people do, especially in a straight relationship. Like usually it's just like, you just forget the condom one time or you just, you know.
Are you cool?
Just like, no, I'm good. Yeah.
You good? Good. Yeah. All right, cool.
Okay. And like, that's not a good conversation.
Like 50% of pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned.
Yeah.
It sounds about right.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. But who knows what that means for those couples. And I'm not even trying to judge people for that. But the way that you describe it, you had conversations about those things. So you did take some precautions. You were an adult having an adult relationship based on all those things. I mean, this is someone's worst nightmare.
It really kind of was at the time, and it was just so surreal. So because in order to get the car insurance settlement, you know, we had this
when he
fancy
totaled his car
SUV thing, he needed to turn in all of the key fobs, and I had one of the key fobs. So I told him I would trade him the key fob for his HIV test results.
Okay.
Oh, good move.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I said,
yeah.
Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
That's even nice too. I mean, because I have people, if even they had not even HIV, if you have even a hand of a herpes, people fucking kick your butt.
One lone herpes.
One lone herpes, one stray cold sore somewhere, your Facebook profile, your Instagram, all your stuff will be on blast.
Even something curable, like 100% curable. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm calling your mom.
Watch out, dude gave me gonorrhea, yo.
Yeah.
Yep, yep.
Everybody putting it everywhere.
Make a Tumblr about it.
Right. Yeah. I did do an Ask Me Anything Reddit after my diagnosis and got some really amazing, interesting, wonderful conversations.
Okay.
Which was really cool to kind of gauge what people's level of interest and knowledge was at the time.
Okay, so you have this key fob.
Did you get the trade?
I did. We trade. So I met him at the Howard County Health Department on January 2nd or 3rd of 2012. And he must have like beat me there because I got there at 9:02 and he was like already in the back. So I totally stalked him in the parking lot until he came outside and he starts like kicking the tires and punching the hood of this car. And I was like, yeah, like told you so. And, you know, he tried to tell me, no, it was a needle stick. And I was like, no, I talked to your ex-wife and you see him like getting paler. And he's like, oh, that was a one-time thing. And I was like, no, I found your Manhunt account. He's, oh, no, that's just for like whatever. I was just looking around. I was like, no, also found all these Craigslist ads.
Here are the receipts.
Right? So it was just kind of this thing. Like, even at, like, this point when there's no way he can possibly deny what happened, he was still trying to, I don't know, protect himself or lie or whatever the motivation was. So, but he never did partner notification, which is where you give the health department the list of people that you have been with. And someone from the health department anonymously reaches out to these people and says, look, you may have been exposed to an STD. Someone cares enough about you to let us know. Would you please come in and get tested? So partner notification nurses and outreach workers have an extremely difficult job of showing up to strangers' houses and being like, hey, can you come with me? I need you to pee in a cup or give me some blood.
Yeah. That's amazing that's a program, because I didn't know that existed.
I did not even know that exists. And now looking back, it's, or just hearing about it, that's immensely important for not only a disease like HIV, but, you know, partner notification. I'm going to hashtag the shit out of that.
Yeah. So I wish you'd had another key fob because you could have maybe done that. So I have two follow-up questions,
I did do that though. Like I started from his email reaching out to people in his email since he wouldn't do it. And then I changed his HIV status on his Manhunt profile and changed the password so that anybody he had hooked up with on Manhunt would know that his status changed.
Good for you. Is that legal?
Probably not.
No, but I mean, I'm
I mean, he's not going to come after you, but I'm just curious because those, I mean, there's a lot of legalities when you're dealing with this stuff, right? And it's great that you reached out to those people. I think you absolutely did the right thing, the moral thing, the only thing anyone should do. I'm appalled that he didn't. My other question was, those healthcare workers that do that, who funds that? Because we're in a political
notification is through health departments, so it would either be county or state funding.
Okay, that's so important that that exists. That's amazing.
I would have never, something so simple is something that I would have never thought about, and that's usually the best things. Now, the best things are the ones that you would assume is just part of what a day-to-day life is. And again, bless your heart for reaching out to those emails, because if, you know, putting myself in your shoes, I wouldn't have the strength to go in those emails and accounts and read those things and be kind enough to like let them know, like, yo, you might have HIV. Even if it'll save a life, I will not have that strength.
And like, it was your anger in some ways, I'm sure also, but like, that's but that's a really selfless thing to do also, because you're not obligated to those people. Mm-hmm. Technically, you're not. You're not the one that made any of these reckless choices. And for you to go and do that, and I mean, that's amazing. And that's why you're an advocate now, I suppose. Same thing, right?
Yeah.
So after that happened, and you reached, did any of those people reply to you, by the way?
Actually, someone did recently, 5 years later, and got really angry at me. I'll go back to, at the time, a couple people did, not a lot of them. One guy was like totally vague, like, why are you telling me this? I don't want to know this information. Don't, you know, message me anymore. But there was one guy that I saw that he was in a relationship with his girlfriend. So I PM'd his girlfriend on Facebook and was like, look, your fiance at the time, now her husband, was sleeping with my boyfriend and my partner that I was living with. You may want to go get tested. But I guess this went into some Facebook other folder. Do you guys?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
But I guess the other folder formula just changed. So this showed up literally 5 years later. And she must have talked to her then fiance, now husband, and been like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
So he messaged me and was like, what is your problem? Stay out of my relationship. You must be a lesbian. And I ignored him. Which, you know. But that didn't stop. So then he started posting on my Facebook page and responding to different posts that I had herpes.
Okay.
And then I tried to report him to the Facebook standards police, and they told me he wasn't violating any standards.
Wow. Which,
right? So you can say someone has herpes, but not like the teeniest tad of like areola can come through anywhere.
Free the nipple. Yeah.
Right?
Only if, like, it's a woman's, though. Only if it's a woman's.
Right. There's like the, like, no butt crack or cheek or.
Right. But you can throw around STIs. Okay.
Right.
I would have posted some interesting thing on his Facebook wall then if that doesn't violate standards.
Right. So then I guess I didn't respond and I just blocked him. So then he started PMing people I knew, like my sister, and was like, do you know Katrina has herpes? And my sister responded very eloquently, she doesn't have herpes, she has HIV. If you're gonna if you're going to harass someone, you should probably get their disease right.
Wow. Good for her, though.
yeah. A friend of mine kind of like helped handle the situation and address it, and finally kind of got his wife to respond by sort of some more like devious internet tactics, which, to protect the innocent,
sure. I'll
make that a little bit vague. But hopefully now she is kind of aware of his behavior and his actions, and I hope that she goes to get tested, because not so much that she would have been infected at this point by my ex, because it's been so long, but obviously if this guy was sleeping with my ex, he's probably been sleeping with other men over the past 5 years behind her back.
Right. And she could be in the same situation that you were.
Right.
Yeah. Except unfortunately married now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Divorce is a lot harder to get out of.
Yeah. So, okay. So you did that and you, the guy and the dog and the kids and everybody were gone from your mom's house. And then what?
So then I just kind of started the process of getting my life back together. I did some therapy. I was lucky that I confided in friends and I had really supportive people and a great social network. I started dating a guy about 7 months later who was completely and totally accepting about my status.
Wait a minute. How does that happen? Because I know you and I have talked about this and I understand it, but I also know that it's a difficult thing because you and I have talked about it. And I'm sure Jonelle is like, totally lost.
I am super lost because I think I'm a normal dude and I can't even get a date. So I'm actually both very interested about the issue at hand, but I will be taking notes.
So, totally.
Yeah. So how does that happen? How do you start to date after that? How do you tell someone that?
How would you even think about another man just having gone through what you've gone through?
Fair question, like,
no,
Jonelle.
Hello, why didn't you just switch to pussy? Right?
I would. I'd be like, I don't know. It's like this is the reason why I really enjoy doing these things is I'm learning a lot and I'm learning things that I'm really strong with and things I'm not. If that happened to me, I'd be locked in my apartment for 25 years, growing a very, very long beard. Probably just
Lucy also knows I really love sex, so celibacy was never really on the table.
Good.
but I think that's a really common misconception that people think that once you have HIV that you stop being sexual, that you stop having sex, that you're dirty or undateable, or that they call it serosorting, so that you should only date other HIV positive people. Which is a little bit easier if you're in the gay male men who have sex with men community.
Sure.
But there are not a lot of straight guys that have HIV just because the risk factors are a lot lower. So even though like there's this concept of serosorting, it's not very practical for a lot of people. I mean, it's also really restrictive, right? Like it's hard to find somebody you like. You just said that. Now I have to find somebody I like who also has HIV. And then I have to like their mom and we have to have some similar interests.
Fair enough.
Right? Like the pool gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And I had some really negative experience where I told people my status and they responded just very horribly and said some truly awful things to me. And actually, so I talked to my doctor about, you know, how do I tell people? Like, you see people all the time who are in relationships. And I knew because I had worked in the field of HIV for 5 years prior that I had seen people who had been in healthy relationships. So I was lucky to know that kind of modeling existed, that from being in this field that I knew that there were people who did meet people after they contracted HIV. There were people who got married. There were people who had healthy babies. And his point was that, you know, at this point, HIV is a really chronic condition. And just as you wouldn't be afraid to date someone with diabetes, that it really comes down to education. And as long as I was able to be comfortable with my status and educate people, and really there is no such thing as a dumb question because nobody knows anything about HIV. Right. The last thing people learned was in high school sex ed, which is your penis or vagina was going to fall off and you were going to die.
I mean, I knew about HIV AIDS through Magic Johnson and he's still kicking it.
He is totally kicking it.
He's although a mogul.
He did not get cured by swimming in money, like they said on South.
He did not. I'm pretty sure he doesn't get blood transfusions every week, too. So.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I used to feel so guilty because I hated giving blood, and now I totally have an out.
Fair enough. Okay, so you learn to be able to answer these questions and to try to let the offensive things that people said to you roll off your back. But how do you when do you tell someone when you were looking to date, for the first time? I mean, were you doing internet dating? Were you meeting people in person? And then
there are actually some internet websites dedicating to, people living with HIV. So if you want that, there's pause.com. There is HIV FlirtNet. There is another one that's sort of a more general, if you have an STD, you can look for other people with STDs that I can't remember right now. But there's a third website. If you Google HIV online dating, there are three different websites dedicated to people who choose that path.
Okay.
So I tried pause.com and HIV FlirtNet. I didn't really find anybody that I was interested in. They also have chat rooms. So I did actually make some friends in the beginning that were people that I could just connect with and talk to, both women and men and people from all over the world that I could kind of connect with, which also helped normalize my experience.
Sure.
To kind of have this like worldwide community of people who were also trying to date and meet people who could share their experiences. And then it just came down, I guess, to really finding the kind of right people and just owning it. And that, you know, I had to kind of say, all right, there are going to be people who will be assholes, but there are going to be people who are assholes about a lot of things.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm an asshole about like so many things, as you know. So.
Right. HIV, beards.
So when you, so you're telling someone on a first date?
Normally like the third date, and it's really funny. Like I liked this guy, not too long ago, because the relationship with that person ended. We were together about 5 years. It was a completely amicable, wonderful, kind breakup. He's my co-producer for Back at You Burlesque. He's a phenomenal person. He's someone who I love deeply and will be in my life for the rest of my life. Just that kind of romantic period is over. And then I met this new guy a couple months ago, and he liked me more than I liked him. And I was kind of hoping, like, if I told him he'd have HIV, that I had HIV, he wouldn't be interested in me anymore.
Okay.
Right. So I was like, maybe this will be my soft out. Like, maybe I can just slide out on this one. Yeah. So, but whatever. I just went the old fashioned way and was like, yeah, this isn't working for me. But at this point, I think because I am so comfortable with it and I am able to tell people, and there's, it's called U equals U. So undetectable equals untransmittable. So if you have HIV virus in your body, but your status is undetectable, you cannot sexually transmit HIV to your sexual partners.
Do you understand so that, Jonelle?
It's a simple equation. So as long as it's undetectable, you're good to go.
Right. As long as you're undetectable, it is untransmittable, meaning you cannot pass HIV on to your partners. And there's a worldwide campaign. There's an organization called Prevention Access Campaign, and they have partners in over 30 countries now. And I think they're close to probably about 300 partners of people who have endorsed this message. The New York City Department of Health has endorsed this message too. And to really get the word out there. And, you know, when I'm with a long-term romantic partner, I have not used condoms.
Okay.
So I'm dating someone new and I don't know their status and they don't know my status. And I mean, like, for everything. I tell people, like, ask for the printout. Like, if someone tells you, like, yeah, yo, I'm good. No.
No. Yeah.
Like, I love that you say that too. I remember having that conversation with you. And I think that is a really good thing because, like, Jonelle and I joked before, not to be flippant about it, but we're like, you good? Yeah, you good? And that is really oftentimes the conversation.
Sometimes it's really awkward. Even that conversation is awkward. But, you know, I remember the longest relationship that I've had in New York, that was our thing. It was like, no, you're going to give me a printout. And I was like, yeah. Oh, awesome. I mean, to a certain extent, the world is so scary that you need a printout. But to the other extent, it's like, okay, we're getting, you're really serious about this. So, and it's,
and you respect yourself and the other person.
Yeah. I mean, it is still scary no matter how much you know how clean you are. Once you're, if as long as that paper is not there, you know, thoughts run into your head, and getting a clean bill of health is very important for everybody involved, romantic or not.
Yeah. So you get that clean.
You should be able to talk about sexual mm-hmm. health with your partner.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you get that printout now, and you tell them that you're HIV positive but undetectable.
Correct.
Correct. And the way that you're undetectable is from your cocktail, right?
Right.
Which and what's
at this point, it's one pill once a day that I take at night before I go to bed with food.
Okay. Sure. I just want to be clear for people that don't know anything, because you educated me a lot. So another right. thing that people can do if they are having sex with someone that they know has HIV, or if they're just having multiple partners, for instance, is what? Tell us about it.
So there's a drug you can take to prevent HIV, and it's called PrEP. So just like there's post-exposure prophylaxis, if you think you've been exposed to HIV, which you should take as soon as you think you've been exposed. They'll give you the treatment up to 72 hours, but they'll start it immediately. Like you can go get it and get the workup within like 4 hours at most emergency rooms in New York City. What you can take beforehand, and the health department does this, Planned Parenthood does this, private doctor's office should, but they're not always great about it. They don't always have the right information. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. And pre-exposure prophylaxis is a drug that you take that prevents HIV infection. So if you're with someone and you don't know their status, if you're with someone who has HIV but isn't undetectable, if you're having sex with a lot of different partners, you can use this drug, PrEP, which it's Truvada is the name of the drug, and it's actually an HIV drug that they use to treat HIV, and it prevents you from becoming infected. Now, just like I have to take my medicine every day to stay undetectable, to have PrEP work most effectively, you need to take that every day as well.
Okay.
And you might have some mild side effects in the beginning. The biggest one is noxious farting, in all honesty. Let's be real.
Farting. Okay.
But once your body gets used to it, you know, the fumes tend to die down and you can resume all your normal sexual activity.
But again, I know there's no stupid question, but a very basic question is, how is this covered? And if you're not, what's the costs of this? Because it seems...
You're always about the dollars and cents, John. No, he wants to know how much it costs
saying that sometimes it's unfortunate that most people that are already going through so much are burdened with additional anchors for them to progress. And it seems like, in your situation, this technically wasn't your fault. You definitely did not deserve this, but you have to have these cocktails on a daily basis.
And what would it cost if you had to pay
just call them, like, because it's one pill, it's really just called ARVs, which mm-hmm. people just say antiretrovirals instead of cocktails, to try to get people to like just think about one pill once a day. That's mm-hmm. a really boring cocktail. Cocktails normally have like lots of cool mixers in them.
Three things to make a cocktail.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So they just call them like ARVs, which is an abbreviation for antiretrovirals. So PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, is normally covered by your insurance company. From a practical sense, it's cheaper to have someone treated for HIV prevention if they've been exposed to treat them for HIV for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
Most insurance companies cover HIV medication. If you are below a certain income level, all 50 states have what's called the ADAP program, which is the Age Drug Assistance Program. The cutoff in New York is like $45,000 or $48,000. I don't know exactly. Each state's a little different. It's normally about 400% of the federal poverty line. And that means that your insurance will cover part of it, and then whatever the copay is, ADAP will pay that for you. Because once again, it's cheaper for the state to pay your copay or pay whatever percentage of the drug isn't covered than for people to have untreated HIV infection.
Now, there's one other organization, correct, that can, if people can't do either of those things, they can get it. You told me about it.
Right. So a lot of times you can go straight to the pharmaceutical companies if your insurance doesn't cover it and get copay cards, which is what I do. So my insurance covers a lot of my medication, but not all of it. So I apply to the pharmacy company and they give me a copay card which writes off the copay because they're still making a lot of money off my insurance company. And then for PrEP, if your insurance doesn't cover it, unfortunately, this is not true in every state, but in New York, there's something called PrEP app that works like ADAP and will help cover all of the routine testing that you need in order to qualify for Truvada for PrEP. And then they help you apply to the pharmaceutical company to get the medication for free.
I was thinking of the boy's name. Do you know what I'm talking
about? Oh, the Ryan White program. Right. So the Ryan White Care Act is a federal program. And the Ryan White Care Act is authorized at the federal level. And then they give the money to states and to cities and to healthcare centers. And ADAP is funded by the Ryan White Care Act.
Okay. Sorry.
Which politically is a little terrifying because the Ryan White Care Act is due for reauthorization. And our Congress is a shit show right now when it comes to healthcare. So it's really incumbent on people to continue to push for saving healthcare rights and making sure nothing bad happens to the Ryan White Care Act, because it's literally life-saving for millions of people.
Yeah. And so you and I discussed this when we were on our way to March on Washington.
We did.
The day after the inauguration. And you expressed concern because early in January, one of the organizations was also shut down by our government.
So the Office of National AIDS Policy is a group that Obama had set up. It might have been there longer than Obama. George Bush II was actually a really big proponent of HIV funding internationally. He did not get a lot of credit for that.
Okay.
So not saying he was great on everything, but he did. But the Office of National AIDS Policy was taken offline. And Obama had created the National HIV AIDS Strategy, which was a nationwide plan to help end the HIV epidemic. That plan is also since been discontinued or not endorsed by Trump. So now the HRSA, which is the agency that's in charge of kind of distributing Ryan White money, are saying their national HIV goals. So what happens is, instead of kind of being, you know, an international leader in preventing the spread of HIV and curing HIV, a lot of those resources and attention are going away. And there's been a lot of people who have left the government because they're not making the right kind of progress in these issues. And people feel like they're going to be more effective in the private sector than they are in the Trump administration.
Okay. And the Ryan White thing is funded federally or privately from those?
Did federally. Yep. Okay. It's federal dollars. And right now there are a lot of people who are going to DC and protesting and organizing and doing sit-in in congressmen's offices and being willing to get arrested to kind of continue to raise awareness for the importance of healthcare money in general and then also for the Ryan White Care Act. So every March there's a day called AIDS Watch, which is specifically dedicated to lobbying for HIV AIDS related causes.
Okay. And so that kind of brings me to my next question, which is, how did you become an advocate for this?
So there was a couple things. One of the first things I actually did, you know, is when I started dating this guy in New York City, was I really wanted to like work on getting my sexy back, which is how I found burlesque. Because sometimes, you know, when you think about living with HIV, it doesn't seem very sexy to be living with an incurable STD. So burlesque really helped me kind of reclaim my sexy and really improve sort of my body confidence and my body image. And nobody was clapping for me when I took my bra off in my own bedroom. You know, you do it at a show, like, you know, one of your shows, Lucy, and everybody's like clapping for you when you take your bra off, and it's fucking amazing.
Sometimes.
Sometimes, right? Maybe they're clapping for you when you're in your bedroom too. Maybe you have like
more luck than I do on that one.
Can we get that sound effect, Jonelle, for the show so that I can just have that anytime?
Just clap.
Just a clap effect. Yeah. I'm going to add that in. He was doing all these like rap horns and stuff, and we got feedback like no more rap horns, but I think we need the clap.
It's not no more rap horns, less rap horns.
Okay, so you found burlesque and that helped you get your sexy back.
I found burlesque, which really made me a lot more confident. And then I became colleagues with a guy, Perry, upstate, who runs the Albany Damien Center, which is a community-based organization for people living with HIV. And he did the talk. He was the speaker for the AIDS Walk every year. And one year he couldn't do it. And he asked me if I would pitch in and do it in his place. And I wrote the speech and I gave the talk and my mom came up to hear it and it was really sentimental and I got a little teary. And I realized that I really loved doing this. So then not long after that, the HIV Stops With Me campaign was looking for new spokesmodels. And Perry encouraged me to apply for the campaign. And it's an awesome campaign. It's HIVstopswithme.org.
Repeat that one more time.
HIVstopswithme.org.
Okay.
And on the website, there are people who are advocates across the state of New York. The campaign is also run in other states. And because it's online, anybody anywhere, you know, nationally or anywhere, anyone who speaks English can look us up. And we do monthly blog posts. We have videos. We can get messages if somebody has a question. And it's really representative. So there are people who were born with HIV, people who got it from drug use, people who got it from sex work, people who got it from being in what they thought were monogamous relationships. There's someone on there who contracted it from sexual assault. So, jeez. But when I,
I just said, geez, like, you know,
right. So yeah, so there's just a really broad community and lots of experiences. And when I applied for the campaign, you know, they asked, why did I want to do it? And I said, because I didn't see anybody on the campaign that looked like me. And I wanted to make sure that people were still thinking about sort of this, you know, kind of generic cisgendered heterosexual woman to make sure that we remember that the HIV epidemic is really universal. And it doesn't matter how much education you have, what color you are, how much money you make, that, you know, anybody is still really susceptible. And if people don't see that, and if people don't see publicly that there are people who look like them, then I don't think they always have a vested interest or identify their own risk factors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's amazing that you did that. I think it's important.
There's like posters. There's actually a poster of me on, I think it's 148th in Amsterdam or like 145th in Amsterdam. You can like go check me out. So the HIV Stops With Me campaign puts up posters. So I've had people take like selfies when they see me on the bus stop, or I took a picture of the one with me on the side of this bodega on Amsterdam Avenue. And I didn't realize like it was the poster and me. And then like on top of it, I only got part of the other ad and it was like, comes with a free can of soda.
That's my kind of joke about a street.
Because hashtag only in New York.
That is true.
Absolutely. So there's one other question I have for you. And, you know, mostly on this, we talk about dating and our likes and dislikes and problems in dating. And you had one really hard rule when we were talking about dating, and you had to like drill it into my brain, the undetectable thing. And we went back and forth, and I'm sure I was as infuriating as everyone else's, but you had one very hard rule, which was something that you don't date men who sleep with other men. Am I phrasing that correctly?
If someone can be open and honest and upfront about their bisexuality, then if they can comfortably have that conversation with me, I think I can have that. I think the problem in that there, I just have a lot of distrust in that. And I feel like it's very hard for me, from my own personal experience, to trust that if someone is dating men, that they're being responsible about it. I know that's my own hang up and my own thing to kind of get over. But for me, it's just, you know, if someone can be open about their bisexuality and comfortable, and I know that that's something that we can discuss and reevaluate, but I just have this concern from my experience that it's hard to really trust. And it is still the highest risk factor, and the highest group of people who are being infected with HIV is young men who have sex with men. And you see that in New York City, you see that nationwide. It's really prevalent among persons of color that are young men who have sex with men. So it's just hard for me to kind of put my toe back in that risk group. I mean, you can't get HIV twice, I guess.
Right.
Well, technically you can. There are two strains of HIV, very rare. But it just, to me, it's not worth the kind of other risk factors and the other high rates of, you know, potentially getting an STD from someone who's also doing that.
Yeah. Sure. And in any relationship, you'd want to feel comfortable and safe and secure. And if, you know, your previous experience gave you a little bit of a traumatic, you know, memory about it, might as well just find, there's plenty of other things that one might enjoy in any relationship too.
Absolutely. I think
you guys talk about all of them on your show.
I mean, I think it's completely understandable. I didn't bring it up as a point of judgment by any means. Mm-hmm. I have the same rule just because, without having had any of the experiences you have. But I think the statistics that you used to back that up was the important part that mm-hmm. I wanted people to hear. Because when you said that to me, coming from you who already has contracted it, that really kind of reiterates that choice for myself and my hard boundaries. That's a dick disqualifier, and that's cool.
Everybody can have their preferences, but it's sometimes the preferences are not just arbitrary. I'm not like just picking, I do not want to be with this kind of person because of X. No, this is a real thing that happened to you. And
you know, and bi men need love too. I'm not saying bi men don't need love too. Bi men definitely do need love too.
But we need honesty.
I think it comes down to just, trust and confidence and just knowing where my comfort level is.
Yeah, most women won't date shorter guys, and we're not crucifying them. So you can have your own preferences. Sometimes it's just, this is, you know, one of those things that every person will have their own baggage. I mean, there's no person free of any issues. And I think it's, you know, it's brave and strong that, hey, you went through all of this. You're allowed to be a little bit more careful with the interactions that, you know, you'd have.
And so, Janelle, did you get to ask all of your questions?
Yes, I'm just still wrapping all of this the story. This is just really fascinating. Sometimes real life is even way better than any movie or TV show that you could actually have.
Well, I think it's a really important story, and I think it's amazing that you share it. Thank you so much for coming on today to talk to us about it and tell our five listeners.
Yeah, or six. The six people that listen to the podcast.
Is there anything else that you want people to know about? Any organizations you didn't get to talk about or anything?
You know, I always say that I made pink sparkly lemonade out of the situation. So I think, you know, the HIV Stops With Me campaign, I think you can learn about being undetectable through the Prevention Access campaign. I think, you know, especially for people who live in New York City, there's Play Safe, Be Sure about HIV testing and accessing PrEP and PEP. I think taking classes at the New York School of Burlesque changed my life and helped me meet some amazing people that I would not even know existed. So that's how I met you, Lucy.
Yes, and Scooter Pie was on our show recently too, and we met through her first, right? And then through the burlesque world, sort of along with that. And now it's been 6 years-ish, mm-hmm. and now you're happy.
I'm so happy. I'm living a life that's just beautiful and wonderful and great. And I have people who love me and awesome sex and friends, and I'm healthy and I'm paying way too much for a ridiculous apartment in Harlem.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being here today. We will put all of your links and everything up so that people can find you and learn more. And that's it.
That's it. That's our pod for today. For all our listeners, feel free to ask follow-up questions. We'll make sure that Immodesty gets it and probably get a follow-up pod just to answer all these fascinating elements of the story. Email us at paradedicks@gmail.com. Follow us at all our social media outlets. Comment on the Podbean. Leave us some stars.
And come out to some shows.
Come out to some shows.
What's your show called, Immodesty?
Back at you, Burlesque.
There you go. That's it. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.